Today's Teisho will be on Case 82, Tai Ryu's Indestructible Dharma Body. Ango's Introduction. The fishing line at the end of the rod. The one with eyes will know. The spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary. The enlightened one will discern. What then is the fishing line at the end of the rod and the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary? See the following. Main subject. A monk said to Tai Ryu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? Tai Ryu said, flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. Secho's verse. The question came from ignorance. The answer was not understood. The moon is clear. The wind is cool. The wintry pine stands on the peak. I laughed heartily to hear the saying, when you encounter a person of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. He held up a crystal whip and smashed the jewels, otherwise faults develop, for there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Perhaps you had the experience of enjoying the walk, the kinhin. You know, if you've been sitting motionless for an hour or for 2 half-hour periods, you know, it's possible that by the end of the second period, you really wanted to move. And yet you're coming back to your breath, or coming back to your koan. And instead of moving, you're focusing on your breath. You're becoming one with your breath. You know, if you got here earlier in the day, if you got here at 8, or even if you got here at 7, you know, after 4 hours of meditation, you know, getting up and walking feels so wonderful. Maybe you had that experience this morning. You know, we stand up, we walk out into that hallway, and then we just slow walk up and down the hallway, you know, and you, if your legs have been constrained for an hour, or for 2 hours, or for 4 hours, you know, being able to move your legs is so beautiful. And you know, it's possible that under other circumstances, if you were at your desk in your office and somebody said you have to run down the hall, you might think, oh brother, do I have to go all the way down the hall? Or if you were at home, you might think, you know, do I have to walk all the, you know, I have to walk all the way down the street to see my neighbor, right? You know, but somehow, you know, after sitting like this, walking is so delicious. It's like perhaps you had the experience of noticing, you know, how delicious it is just to move. You know, to put one leg in front of the other, you can feel those muscles stretching, you can feel the firmness of the floor under your foot. You can feel your foot. You know, it becomes beautiful. It really becomes beautiful. And even though it might not have been something that occurred to you, you know, probably when you were walking down the hall, you were in a very different mental state from when you came in this morning, and probably from your ordinary mental state. You know, if you're doing many different things in your job and you have to interrupt yourself and walk down the hall, and it's a long hallway like this one, you know, during the whole time you're walking down the hall, you're thinking you should be back at your desk. You've got to get that done before you leave for the day. And so it's almost like there's a heavy weight pulling you down as you're trying to take these steps. Or maybe, you know, you have to walk down the street to see a neighbor and it's somebody you don't particularly want to see, or maybe you just wish you were doing something else that afternoon. You know, probably the whole time your mind was occupied with what you wanted to do or what you could have been doing or how difficult it is going to be to encounter your neighbor and deal with that. You know, but when we walk down the hall, you know, after sitting for an hour or 2 hours or even 4 hours, you know, it's a different experience. And probably it was the case that at times, you know, there were very few thoughts or no thoughts in your mind at all. You know, after sitting for a while, you know, we shift into a different mental space. You know, at first, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, your mind is buzzing like a beehive. But if you keep watching the breath, you know, the thoughts become fewer and fewer. And it's as though they move over to the side and the focal point of your attention becomes the breath. And so each time you follow the breath out, you know, you're bringing your attention away from that stream of thoughts and you're bringing it back to the present moment. And if you're a little bit uncomfortable, you know, if you're a little bit uncomfortable, it actually helps, you know, because if you're feeling some discomfort in your legs, you know, you can't really focus comfortably on those thoughts. You know, you can't escape into your thoughts if you're feeling physical discomfort. Generally speaking, that doesn't work. So if you're feeling a little bit uncomfortable and you focus on the breath, you notice not only do the thoughts go away, but as you follow the breath out, you know, the pain recedes or your discomfort recedes. And then it comes back when you breathe in, but you sweep the pain away or you sweep your discomfort away. And as this is going on, you're dropping deeper and deeper into samadhi, deeper and deeper into concentration. And samadhi is usually this state where thoughts might not completely go away, but they're on the margin of your attention. And it's even possibly the case that when you have thoughts, they don't particularly feel like your thoughts. There's just thoughts coming and going like clouds in the sky. And when you get off the cushion after doing that for an hour and you walk, you know, you have a completely different relationship to your body. You know, normally when we walk, you know, we might not even be aware that we're walking. The body is like a machine. We're getting in this machine and we're using it to drive down the hallway to talk to somebody. And, you know, I have had the experience myself of coming home at the end of a day and finding a bruise on my leg and thinking, how did I get that bruise? You know, and I must have bashed into some desk during my, you know, at some point in the day, but I was so distracted that I didn't even notice it. Maybe I was getting up to give a presentation, and on the way to the podium, you know, I bashed into something. But my mind was so fixed on what I had to say and what I had to do that I was totally oblivious. You know, it's almost like, you know, you're not in your body much of the time. We have this relationship with our bodies which is very disembodied, you know. And so, you know, we sit for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, you get up, and just being able to stretch is quite delicious, but, you know, taking those slow steps with your breath, accompanied by your breath, and in a rather thoughtless state, it's a completely different kind of experience. And it's possibly the case that as you're walking down the hall and up the hall, you know, you feel this kind of like, it's like gratitude. It's like walking is so beautiful. Just walking is so beautiful. You know, and yeah, I'm so grateful for my body. It's just so grateful to be able to walk, to be able to breathe. I'm really grateful to be able to sit, to do zazen, to do meditation. And maybe some of those things happen to you as we're walking today. You know, this is a little taste of the Dharma, a little taste of the Buddha's way. Just this kind of relationship to the body and relationship to the world is very different from the way we ordinarily encounter things. So, you know, I have, this is the end of the week for me. Yesterday I had to be a administrator, and I had to write a an appeal to a judgment by a branch of the university. So the branch of the university decided that my office had not followed regulation 3.12. And they sent me a finding saying, you are in violation of regulation 3.12, item B. And I myself have never heard of regulation 3.12, item B. But I was upset to see that I was in violation of this code. So I had to consult the codes, the university regulations, and find out what this regulation was. And I wasn't starting from scratch. This involved an incident with one of the teachers in the program that I direct. And we had responded to his behavior in a certain way, and then there was a formal complaint was made by the student, and that's a good thing, that students can make a formal complaint. And then there was a 6-month investigation, and the teacher in question was found to be not in violation, but my office was found to be in violation for the way we handled the case. And so all week long I've been working on a response or an appeal to the finding. And it's a little bit maddening, you know. Because, as I said, you know, when this process started, I didn't know about this regulation. And the detailed finding had got many facts wrong. Because the people who conducted the investigation knew nothing about my program or the teachers or even the students. And so I had to spend the week consolidating all this information and going through their report and making a counter report. And then I had to send it off. And I wanted to do it properly, and I spent hours and hours doing this. And it will go back, and I expect my appeal to be denied, as a matter of fact. Nevertheless, I wanted to get on paper the position of my office, which was that we don't feel we're being justly blamed for an incident that didn't happen, as a matter of fact. So all of this sounds a little crazy, because it is. You know, a friend of mine was telling me that the Chronicle of Higher Education has an article recently about all the bureaucracy in the university. You know, when I came to Rutgers University 30 years ago, if I had a problem with a teacher, I would just call the teacher in and say, you haven't been showing up for your classes. Why haven't you been showing up for your classes? And if the teacher said, oh, I forgot to go, we generally fired that person. And if that person went to the union, we have a wonderful union here at Rutgers, the union representative would come in with the teacher, and we would discuss it, and in an hour we would reach an agreement, and then it was over. But now, you know, if something like this happens, I have to file all this paperwork. I have all these forms I have to fill in. And it goes up to an investigator I've never met, and the investigator investigates for months and months and months and makes a finding. and the finding might be totally wrong. So I don't know if any of this sounds familiar to you, but this is, you know, many academics, many teachers got into this. If somebody had said to me 40 years ago, do you want to be an English professor? I might have said yes. If somebody said, do you want to teach writing? I might have said yes. If somebody said, do you want to spend weeks and weeks filling in forms? I would have definitely said no. You know, this is happening all over the United States. You know, when I came to Rutgers, we could settle problems very quickly. Now I've noticed, you know, when I would walk to lunch, when I got here to Rutgers 30 years ago, I would see all my fellow professors and all of my students, and I would see graduate students and part-time lecturers. Now, when I go to lunch, I see all these people that I don't know, and they're wearing like really expensive suits. And I think those are the administrators, you know. You know, they're the ones who write the reports about me or make the findings. And my friends who are like professors, they all have blue jeans on and jackets, and these guys have like very nice suits. So something's changed about the university. It's becoming more and more bureaucratic. And I think lots of faculty members feel like not only are they losing control over their own destiny, over what happens to them, but it's like the life, if you're not careful, you can feel like the life is going out of the institution, you know? Like the life is going out of all this. You know, basically, you know, the effect of all this paperwork and all these findings is that people become very worried about almost anything they do. You know, almost anything they do. So if I go into my class and I tell a certain kind of joke, for example, you know, that might lead to my discipline against me, you know. Or at least it could lead to an investigation that could go on for 3 months. Now, it's definitely the case that if somebody behaves in a way that's discriminatory or sexist, that person should be reprimanded. And, you know, if it's repeated, that person should be fired. But you know, the way all of this happens is so bureaucratic and so complicated that I think everybody feels a little bit like they're walking on eggshells. And you know, what you wind up doing is being very afraid of trying anything new. You know, anything new. You know, a part of our program is in the graduate school, and the graduate school hired a statistician, and by the way, you know, statisticians are great, to come in and analyze the effectiveness of the graduate writing program. And this statistician was coming into every classroom and observing the number of students in the class each time. And he was actually measuring time to task on various tasks that the students were doing. And I met with him and the dean of the graduate school, and I said, you know, this is really not a good way to assess our program. It's a writing program. Have you ever thought of looking at the writing? And he said, yes, we're developing a bot that's going to read the papers. And I said, you know, we got into a very heated discussion about why bots can't read papers. You know, so the effect of this, you know, I had to actually sort of have like a little fight with this guy, you know, basically to say, you can't do these things to my teachers, you know, and I actually won that round. But he was sort of taking over the class and transforming the way everybody behaved in the classroom so that he could measure it. Well, you know, all of this has an effect on people. You know, my teachers were getting to be paranoid about this guy coming in and noting who was absent, like they were responsible if a student didn't show up. And they were very worried that bots would be reading the student papers and making assessments based on things like word count or vocabulary, instead of like the content of the argument. So all of this has the effect, I think, of making people afraid to do almost anything, you know, almost anything. And so this has an effect on people in many different ways. You know, when you get up in the morning, do you want to come into work? You know, if you feel you're being constantly monitored, do you want to come into work? If you feel you can't be relaxed around your students, do you want to be in the classroom? You know, if you feel that your work is going to be assessed by unfair standards, you know, that's very demoralizing. And, you know, people respond to these sorts of things in different ways. You know, some people get really angry. There are older faculty I know who just can't wait to retire. It's like, I'm out of here. And there are younger people I know who just, you know, they sort of feel like they're going to come in, do their job, and go home. And, you know, the life goes out of the institution. People can't sleep at night, you know. People develop anxiety disorders. Yeah, this is really true. You know, people develop substance abuse problems because of this kind of a cultural environment. You know, I was reading in the newspaper, there was a therapist who was talking about, they asked her if Donald Trump was mentally ill. And I think she thought the question was not a very interesting question because it's so obvious that he is. So instead she said, I'm not really particularly interested in Donald Trump's mental state, but I am very interested in the mental state of Americans right now in his in the country he's created. And she talked about basically the number of patients she saw who were coming into her with anxiety-related disorders. And maybe depression even, because of the climate in our culture. These things, you might not be directly affected by very many of Trump's decisions, you know. We have a wonderful teacher in our program who's from Taiwan. And he came in to see me and he said, you know, I have a my wife and I just had a little child, and I realize I'm never going to get to be a citizen here in the United States now that with Trump's administration in power, and I'm thinking of leaving and going back to Taiwan or going to Japan. His wife is from Japan and he speaks really excellent Japanese. And I wanted to beg him not to go because he's such a valuable person, but I can't blame, I didn't do it because I understand his situation, you know. I think he'd, I felt like saying, do they have any jobs for me in Taiwan? I know this has caused him a lot of distress emotionally. You know, I think it's gotten to him. You know, I think he worries. He lies awake at night and worries about this. And I think he carries a lot of anxiety around with him. So you know, it should be pretty clear that we don't have a very healthy culture. But I think we underestimate the degree to which it can get under our skin. You know, it gets under our skin. You know. When I was in high school, it didn't occur to me at the time, but when I was in high school, I had a lot of problems in my life. My parents were getting divorced, and they had like a really bitter divorce. And we were living in after my parents got divorced, we were living in a one-bedroom apartment. And, you know, there were a lot of financial problems, a lot of unhappiness. And early on in that whole process, I realized, you know, that I could be good at school. And if I was good at school, it would get me out of all of this sadness, you know. So I became like a really great student in high school because I saw being a good student as my ticket out of many unhappy things. And I really worked hard. You know, if I had to study for an algebra test, you know, I would study like hours and hours. And I actually once went in and took an algebra test in, you know, like I finished the test in half the time. I turned it in. And my teacher said, do it again. And she gave me two A's. Because I did it in half the time. I did twice the test in half the time. And she was so happy that I was doing well in my algebra. And I was getting all this good feedback from my teacher, right? So, you know, my home was very unhappy. But my school, my teachers would look at me with a happy face, like they approved of me. And that was so great because I didn't get that at home, right? So I really wanted to do good in school. And I put tremendous pressure on myself to be like an A student in every subject. You know, so if I had to do an essay and it was a 5-page essay, that I would write more and I would revise. And I'd get, my teacher would say, oh, your essay is so good. In fact, you know, I had a teacher in 10th grade, Mrs. Brown. She doomed me to unpopularity by saying, you know, Kurt writes the best essays in the class. After that, you know, forget it. Nobody wanted to talk to me. I was a total geek, a total nerd. But, you know, I wanted to get out of my family life and my personal situation. And this was my ticket, and I was succeeding. You know, but what would happen is, you know, every once in a while I would screw up. I wouldn't get an A plus. You know, I'd get a B plus on my trigonometry exam. And I would come home and I would actually be ill. You know, I would feel like I was going to throw up. You know, and I would be depressed. I didn't do things like cutting myself, right? But almost, you know, I felt very mad at myself, very, very down on myself. And I would definitely, you know, beat myself up. Like, this must never happen again, right? You know, so it doesn't take much insight to see that I completely made my high school years miserable for myself. And I never did anything in high school academically that had any connection with what I happened to like or love, right? I just wanted that approval. And it actually like affected my body. I would actually get nauseous, you know. Later, when I was in graduate school, I was under a lot of pressure. And there was that, you know, my stomach would be killing me. You know, just like grinding, my stomach would be grunting, just like in high school. So, you know, we internalize all this stuff, you know, and it affects us on a very deep level, much more than we think. You know, you think you could turn off the news, but the news is in you. You know, and you know, society is changing in ways that are not necessarily positive and don't make people feel like they have a lot of control over their lives. You know, in the old days in my department, if we wanted to hire a new secretary, we interviewed secretaries and we hired them. Now we get to interview them, but we don't actually hire them. A bureaucrat hires them. And so we interview the person and we recommend to the administrator above us the hiring of so-and-so. But he or she makes the decision. So we don't even get to pick the people we work with. So, you know, there are many people I know in my department who are really bothered by this. They feel very troubled. They lie awake at night, they get a grinding stomach, or they have high blood pressure. I remember, you know, when I was out of college, I worked construction for a while. And I remember going out to one construction site, and on the construction site, the foreman, this was the first day of this project, he hired like 20, I was a carpenter, he hired 20 carpenters. And we each had he divided us into teams, and each team had to work on this house. Each team had a house of its own to work on. And he let us all work, and he just sat there all day watching us work. And he fired 15 people and kept the 5 fastest guys. And I could see that that was what he was doing, and I was trying to put this sheeting up faster and faster, you know. And at the end of the day, I wasn't fast enough, you know. Know people in the building trades, you know, who have lived their lives like that, you know, and a lot of them have substance abuse problems, you know. So, our culture isn't healthy, and we internalize a lot of this stuff. And we think it doesn't affect us, but it can affect us on a very deep level, even like on the level of our bodies. You know, so it's not possible, really, just to decide you're not going to take this stuff in. You know, it's not possible just to say, well, I'm going to turn the news off and not watch it, you know. Because, you know, actually the whole culture is changing around us all the time. And we can't really escape, in a way, from what's happening. It seeps in under the door. It seeps in through the window. You know, it's on the radio. It's on the, you know. So, you know, one way to think about Buddhism is that it's a process of liberation on every level, the level of our personal life, the level of our physical experience, and actually the level of society. You know, many people think of meditation as a way of coping with stress. So, you know, if you have stress on the job, you can do some mindfulness meditation, and the next day you'll be less stressed and you'll be more effective. And that is a good thing, but if it just stops with that, you know, nothing really changes. You know, the society stays the same. So, you know, one way to think about Buddhism is that it comes out of a moment. Actually, the Buddha lived in India at a time when people were still free. Buddhism comes from northeastern India, and there were these little democratic republics. The legend says the Buddha's father was a king, but Buddha's father wasn't a king. The Buddha's father was like a like the governor of the state, basically. They had a parliament. The people in the Buddha's republic, called the Shakya Republic, had a parliament. They followed majority rule. And in the Buddha's own lifetime, that country, the Shakya nation, was conquered by a military dictatorship. But the Buddha actually continued to teach, and he gave people the tools they needed to push back against this experience. You know, meditation is not just about feeling better, it's about liberating yourself and then transforming society. You know, I think in the back of the Buddha's mind was this idea that you have to create like a democracy in yourself, freedom in yourself, and then you can begin to create freedom in the world. But you can't really create freedom in the world if you're still in chains inside yourself. You know, so Buddhism starts with liberating our body, you know, liberating our body and our mind from these like internalized obstacles and creating like a healthy ecology inside of ourselves. And the idea is that if we can recover our health, our freedom, you know, freedom from all of this negative conditioning, we can begin to be positive force in the world. So, you know, one of the things that all of this pressure on us does is to make us shut down. You know, every time you watch Trump, every time you listen to Trump on the radio, you might have the desire to just get in a plane and fly to Canada right away. It's a totally human desire. But you know, what will happen if you fly to Canada is, yes, you'll be in a great place. But what about this other 320 million Americans who are still here? So, you know, being in pain or suffering, being fearful or feeling threatened makes us close down and cut off our connections to other people. You know, so, really, Zazen begins by opening us up inside of ourselves and then restoring our natural sense of connectedness to other people. See? And that's what this pressure from outside is designed to eliminate. That sense of everybody becomes, you could say, atomized. Everybody becomes a frightened individual locked in his own body. And the body itself becomes kind of locked up. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was first here at Rutgers, I was so stressed during the day that I actually, my shoulders would actually hurt by the end of the day. My shoulders were so tight from stress. You know, I had a friend of mine who used to have chronic back problems, and he went to all these specialists, and they'd look at his spine and say, there's nothing wrong with your spine. It's how you deal with your stress. You know, by the end of the day, his back was screaming because all of those muscles were tight. So, you know, we sit down on the cushion and we watch the breath, and whatever is in there is going to come up. So, you know, maybe there's Mr. Trump saying something that is unbelievably stupid and terrifying, right? And you keep coming back to your breath and coming back to your breath, you know, maybe after half an hour, you know, you begin to calm down. Usually takes about half an hour to calm down. And then you do walking meditation and you sit back down. And then, you know, somewhere in that second 35-minute period, you know, you begin to find in yourself this stillness. And you begin to feel calm and grounded, and the thoughts begin to recede, and you're unifying yourself with your breath. And, you know, if you do that for another half hour, and, you know, it's a Wednesday night, you have tea, and, you know, all of a sudden this tea is so delicious, right? And you might think, what kind of brand of tea do we use? In fact, we do use a very good tea. Yen brings tea from Taiwan, so it's really like the world's best tea. But you know, even if it were Lipton's, which is possibly the world's worst tea, if I may say so, even if it were Lipton's, it would be delicious. Because what makes it delicious isn't the tea, it's us, right? You know, after deconditioning ourselves for an hour, you know, if you're upset, you can't even taste the tea. You know, if you're listening to Trump on the radio and you start drinking tea, it's like, what did I just drink? You know, was it tea? I hope I didn't drink something. You know, what did I just drink? You know, after an hour of Zazen, you sit down and you've entered that stillness, right, in yourself. That blankness in yourself, and you get up and you have the tea, and it's just like the tea is like heavenly nectar. You know, the date, you could eat a bag of dates while you're watching TV, but if you eat the date after Zazen, it's like that was heaven. You know, I've never tasted a date so good. Where do these dates come from? And, you know, we get off the cushion, and you could see people's faces are more open. you know, at the end of a sitting period, sometimes on a Wednesday night or a Friday night, I can't get people to leave the zendo. You know, everybody's talking, they're enjoying each other's company, you know. And I'm so happy that they're in that place. I don't think they were in that place when they came in necessarily, right? You know, when we sit down together and do zazen, you know, we go through this deconditioning process and we get back to this fundamentally enlightened consciousness at the center of our lives, at the center of ourselves. And we might not make dramatic contact with it, but we're taking away the layers of conditioning and we get closer to it and we feel better and better. Even if you had a sit where you sat down on the cushion and your mind was buzzing the whole time, or even if you had a sit where your legs were bothering you, you just couldn't get in a good position, probably when you get off the cushion, you feel better nevertheless. It's like the tension in your shoulders is a little less. You feel looser. You know, I've been doing this for 40 years. When I, you know, after a Saturday sit, I feel like every molecule in my body has been massaged, you know. I don't feel that way coming in either. I certainly didn't feel that way last night going through these pettifogging details, wondering if anybody will even read this report, you know, before they reject it, you know. So you know, definitely our culture isn't healthy, but you know, the path to freeing ourselves starts with sitting on the cushion and purifying body, mind, and heart. And purifying means reaching that stillness, that blankness or emptiness, and letting that sort of undo all the knots in our body, all the knots in our mind. And, you know, when you get off the cushion at the end of an evening or at the end of a Saturday sit, you know, so many of your barriers are down, you know. So many of your barriers are down. I have to be careful after sesshin, you know, because I've been doing this for a long time, and after a sesshin, my barriers are definitely down. And I go into work and I, you know, sometimes I'll find myself hugging somebody and they're sort of looking at me like, what the hell, you know? And it's like, oh yeah, I'm not at sesshin anymore, right, you know? And, you know, they'll laugh or something nervously, you know, but, you know, it's a little weird, I admit, you know, but I'm just not, my barriers have not been raised up again, right? You know, so I'm feeling very connected to everybody. And that's a good place to be. I mean, actually, people like to be hugged. Even deans like to be hugged. If you catch them, you know, at the right moment, it's like, oh, what are you doing? And then, oh, that was rather nice, you know. You know. They don't get hugged very often, see? They mostly get slammed. So when they get slammed, they become cautious. See, this is what I was talking about. You know, they get slammed enough, and then they dare not say anything. It's just like it's like you go through life keeping your head down. You know, you teach your class and go home. You don't try anything. You don't want to give your students anything too controversial, or they might, you know, complain to somebody. So you just, but you know, giving the dean a hug, I have actually done that, and it has worked out well for me. You know, I mean, the person said, "Let's go to lunch," you know, and we went to lunch, and we have a good friendship now. So being a little bit foolish, maybe, and a little bit open can sometimes really be transformative for yourself and also for others. You know, I think this is kind of what the Buddha had in mind. You know, when the Buddha's country was invaded by this military dictatorship, you know, he must have thought to himself, now what? Right? And you can organize a rebel army, but the real enemy isn't the guy who invaded the country. It's the mental habits that produced that, right? You know, that's the real enemy. So you can kill Trump, but you have to get rid of the Trump in yourself, right? And that's much harder, actually. You know, somebody could assassinate a dictator, but what about the dictator in yourself? You know? And I don't mean to suggest that we're all Hitlers, but we all have a fearful, angry part of ourselves, lashing out at others, trying to beat others to the punch, you know, because we've been punched. So doing this work is so important, right? You know, the fear makes us shrink down and get smaller and smaller. And when we shrink down, we become desperate, and then we become greedy or attached to things. So, you know, when people feel optimistic and safe, they're very generous. You know, generally speaking, very generous. When people feel threatened and endangered, they become much less generous. They become possessive and competitive, right? So, you know, fear produces attachment. And then, you know, attachment and fear together, you know, lock us up. And the Buddha must have seen this. You know, you can overthrow the dictator, but what about the dictators in all of us? It's the mental habits that create this that the Buddha tried to change. And you can take over the presidential palace, you know, and you can shoot all the bad guys, but those mental habits have to change. Nothing will change unless those change. So we start by taking the chains off ourselves inside our own minds. And it's as simple as watching the breath and entering samadhi. And little by little, you know, we learn how to get opened up again, how to open up. Inside every human being, even Trump, is this radiant Buddha nature. This is the teaching, you know. And the Buddha was not a fool, you know. In the Buddha's own lifetime, his country was invaded. His people were subject to like a genocide. The king, who was his close personal friend, was murdered by his own son. You know, so the Buddha lived in a time of great turmoil, just like now. In fact, much worse. You know, and yet, you know, he continued to teach this path. You know, the way out starts with your breath. Watching the breath, sweeping thoughts away, and gradually deconditioning yourself. And, you know, it's important to do this every day or often. You know, when people are stressed or distressed, you know, they come home and watch the tube, but that doesn't purify body, mind, and heart. That just distracts you. You know, having a drink actually doesn't purify body, mind, and heart. It just distracts you. You feel elated for a while, you go to bed, you get up, and you're just as depressed as ever, if not more. You know, even going to like Hawaii doesn't really pure, though it's nice, I liked Hawaii when I went, and I'd like to go again, but it didn't purify body, mind, and heart. You know, it really didn't. It's nice to be in Waimea, you know, Canyon, it's beautiful, but you've got all your karmic baggage right there, you're just distracted. It's still there, right? But, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you purify body, mind, and heart, and at some point you get up and you feel this deep sense of connection. See, deep sense of connection to other people. This body, my body, is a 63-year-old body. 63 years from now, I hope I'm still doing zazen. It's not likely, however, right? You know, we all are going to get sick, get old, and we're all going to die. But when we enter deep samadhi and we clear away our obstacles and we get off the cushion or on the cushion, you hear the wind. and you realize the wind is part of this body. You know, a friend of mine, a Dharma sister of mine, said she got on the bus once and turned and saw the face of somebody else and basically started crying. She felt it was her face. Well, it is her face. Fear and attachment separate us from each other. Fear and attachment make our world smaller and smaller, but the Buddha's way takes us in the opposite direction. We realize our lives are connected to everybody else's lives. See, my indestructible body isn't this body, it's our body. It's your body and your body and the ground we stand on and the trees and the sky and everything that we're connected to. See, following the Dharma is learning how to live in that body more and more. And then taking that freedom out with you to your job, to your family, everywhere you go. This is the only way out, in my opinion. Tai Ryu's indestructible body, Engo's introduction. The fishing line at the end of the rod, the one with the eyes will know. See, isn't that like Zazen? You sit down on the cushion, you don't know what's going to happen. It's like throwing a line into the water. Something under the surface begins to stir. That's your true nature. The spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary, the enlightened one will discern your connections with others. What then is the fishing line at the end of the rod and the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary? See the following. Subject, main subject. A monk said to Tai Ryu, a man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible body? Tai Ryu said, he says it right out loud. He says it right directly. Flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. This whole world is your true body. Setcho's verse, the question came from ignorance. The answer was not understood. Yet the moon is clear, the wind is cool. The wintry pine stands on the peak. I laugh heartily to hear the saying, when you encounter a man of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. He held the crystal whip and smashed the jewels. Otherwise, faults develop. We just keep cleaning up our karma day after day, sit after sit. For there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations where everywhere we turn, we're blocked, right? But not really, not really.